actually was very heavily involved in the final in coming up with a final draft that's on the website. And we would like to encourage you to go to the website and download the document for details, because we're not going to have time to go over each fact. So there were four CCs that gave us reasons, or gave us their position on wildcarding. There were two that were still involved in wildcarding, and explicitly expressed the desirability, so to speak, of wildcarding, or the usefulness of wildcarding, in order for them to serve their users. That was .vn and .ph. And as for the specific arguments, I would again encourage you to go to the website and download the final report, or the draft final report, and we will come up with a final report after this. And there was .nu, who had stopped wildcarding, but also stated that that the standards of IETF and the ESAC were not in tune, and so as for clarification, there was one that stated that it was doing some sort of redirection because of the necessity to provide IDN .kr services, and that was .kr. And so based on Andres's demonstration of the different lists that we come up with when we use the different methods, we decided that we do not have a final list. That the initial list of 11 CCs were given to us by IANA, and even that was not comprehensive. And so we term this as an anecdotal list of harms. And so we looked at the behaviors of seven of these CCs, and some come up with page not found, some come up with ads, some come up with tell you that the domain may be available. And so what we did was, based on the list of the harms that were identified by the ESAC and the ICANN staff, that was the list that was presented earlier in this presentation, we tried to see which of the CCs, which behaviors of the CCs apply to which. And we found that, and this exercise was done by Catherine and Rungan Mo, I understand, and we thank them for that. And it was found that some of these would apply to all CCs involved in wildcarding, and some of these behaviors would be dependent on what their registration policies were, and so on. And some of these would also apply to certain CCs that were more heavily involved in additional wildcarding activities. And so we came up with this mapping exercise. The specific mapping mechanism is also included in the final report. And so we came up with three recommendations. First one, dialogue. We asked each CCs that we were given, the list of the 11 CCs that we were given, we asked them what their reasons were for wildcarding. And during that process, it was found that four of the CCs stopped. And we also learned that for some CCs, it was necessary. Some CCs actually had gone through the sort of the proper consultation process and had a different opinion. And so we realized that a dialogue with the CCs is very important, but that we felt that it would only succeed if judgment on the reasons for use is suspended. So although we use the word harms, and we don't mean to use it in a really negative way, we just used it that word because that was the word used by the ESAC and the ICANN staff. And so we are not making any judgments. We are trying to, engage in dialogue. And the second point is that we really need a clear identification of what wildcarding is and how to identify these CCs that are involved in wildcarding, and so that we can come up with a more comprehensive list. And then after that mapping exercise, it was felt that the different harms were exhibited by different CCs, depending on the manner in which the registries use redirection, and without making a judgment on the desirability or the undesirability of each, we would like to recommend that the council consider determining which harms or behaviors are less harmful. Was the wording that was suggested. That was suggested by Patricio, because harms is not desirable in any way. But, I mean, even given that, we are not making a judgment. But basically, we would like to recommend that the list that we differentiate between items in the list as to which is more involved in wildcarding and which is less, basically. And that's it. Andres, would you like to add?
No, that's all. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any questions or comments on the report, which will formally go to the council tomorrow, and the council may immediately do something or may need to think about it or whatever, but the report will go to the council tomorrow, so it's on our agenda. If there are no... Hiro, I'm so sorry, Hiro. It's on.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. So, congratulations on the intensive study report. I see for each CCTLD who does wildcarding, as far as the study group identified, the reason for using wildcard is reported. So, my question is, did the study group study on how essential the wildcarding is or was in such CCTLDs for their core services as a registry? Here, essential means, for example, necessary and having no alternative ways to do that. Such study may help us to understand the balance between necessity and harm of the wildcarding. If such study hasn't yet been done, it should be clarified through more dialogues recommended in the report. The last part is my comment. Thank you.
Thank you for the comment. Basically, there is a list of all individual CCTLDs and their reasons why they were using wildcarding. And basically, there are just two reasons that we found. There are some technical reasons, and they are usually tied with IDN. And for example, Korea is a good example because the Korean registry declared that they will stop using it when the final technical solution is done on the web browser side, for example. And there are some CCTLDs that make it mainly from commercial reasons, which is, for example, .ph, and they probably would like to continue with that thing.
I would also like to add thank you, Hiro, and I would also like to add that criteria could be one of the items that we may use to differentiate between the list of items here. So it would actually help us further specify get more detailed about the differences between the items in the list, and that would be a very good criterion to use. Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay, well, Andre Youngham, thank you very much. And as I said, the council will take the report tomorrow and we'll see what happens next. Thank you. Jörg, would you like to come up and do the instant response working group?
There we go. So thanks, Chris, for the introduction. It's my pleasure to give you an update on the progress that has been made by the Incidents Response Working Group. And just in case you can recall, I would like to, in the first place, acquaint you once again with our purpose. So our charter says that we are about to implement mechanisms for the engagement of and the interaction with ccTLD registries during incidents that may impact the DNS. And as to this, the scope of the group would be to set up a repository and of contacts and according channels of communication. So as to this, we set up the following work plan that has been laid out in Nairobi. And the first issue was to define what is supposed to be considered an incident for this working group. Well, we did so, and came up with the following definition: what is supposed to be an incident for this working group. And that is a large-scale unintended misfunction of the DNS or a systematic rigorous preparation of or actual attack on the availability of both DNS and registration systems, on the data integrity or privacy of both of those systems, or the stability and security of the internet at large, where there is a coordinated international response by operators and supporting organization advised. So this is probably something interesting, as I would like to remind you that this definitely does not include that we take a closer look at malicious use of the internet itself, for example. So we're not concerned with spam. We're not concerned with unlawful use or misuse of specific domains or content. And we do not care about any routing problems. So once we do know what's supposed to be an incident, we had to define use cases of the envisioned contact repository. We did that as well, and basically the list of the use cases does look like that, and you just could title them in two different categories. One would be information exchange, so a scenario for the use of the contact repository would be to provide a security contact point under any circumstances, and we would want to issue early warnings. Second category would be counteraction, and over here we see a scenario or use case that we would like to inform participating community about an incident, and that we would facilitate or enable the community support for a member of such community. And once again, let me point out what has been dismissed, because these use cases got a tendency to be very narrow, as I feel, So there actually had been discussions like we wanted to generate reports on prevention best practices, and we would store, compile, and give access to meditations, lessons learned. But we leave that to, well, at least a second version of the contact repository. We don't even feel that we would provide generic action plans, and we for sure would have to reflect that in the charter, because that is one point that has been said in the charter. And finally, we don't see how we could, by just such a repository, come up with anything that could coordinate responses with just the plain repository. So as to this, point three of the work plan is probably just not going to take place. Task four, so once we came up with the use cases for such a contact repository, then we could easily define a data model, or at least an attribute list, according to such use cases for a contact repository. Well, over here you see a very first version of this attribute list, and in a darker gray part you'd see the information that gives some aspects of organizational concerns. In a lighter gray shadowed part, you'd see in black some information about the contact person itself, be it the first incident response contact or be it a substitute that should also be named within the contact repository. And written down in green, actually, you see the real contact channel and information we do envision to be integrated in this contact repository. Well, finally, we didn't come to terms, and it wasn't as planned as well, that we already know who is going to implement, who is going to run and maintain such a repository. So this work still has to be done, as well as getting clear about at what expenditure this is going to be covered and who is going to do it. So finally, further discussions that had been going on in the working group is we were concerned with who is entitled to access such a repository anyway. And I would like to point out that we came up with the impression that it should not only be accessed by CCTLD members, but by TLDs in general, and not only them, but DNS operators and registry operators as well. Concerning the tools one might envision that probably would be associated with such a repository, we have been discussing quite a number of functions that we could envision. Even something like Twittering information or web 2.0 functionality, so where you can get into trusted contact to somebody else who you do not know personally, but somebody else knows. So I think you're quite familiar with that kind of functionalities. So we have been discussing that, and we left it open to probably a second version, but basically come to terms that we do not want to provide anything that exceeds the mailing list so far. Last point is what also has been raised in Nairobi was that there has to be a clarification on the relation or the delineation of the incident response working group with respect to organizations that already do exist and that are more or less obliged with related or similar tasks. And over here, at least concerning the envisioned DNS cert, there has been some action. And that was that after the Nairobi meeting, the charter of the working group was amended in such a way that the working group should only include, as it says, aspects and relations with ICANN's DNS cert initiative it considers relevant, and that we would seek input and feedback from you, the community, and try to coordinate this input towards the DNS cert initiative. Well, it took a while to amend the charter, and basically what has happened was that we were kind of overtaken, so there already had been, in the progress of the Nairobi meeting, a substantial commenting on the DNS cert initiative anyway. So at this point in time, I just do not feel that it is necessary to further comment on anything that has been proposed so far. So what are we going to do with the amended charter, and how are we going to cope? So the plan is that if ICANN will initiate steps for the bottom-up multi-stakeholder approach to ensure DNS security and stability, and that for sure was what was envisioned, for example, by the CCNSO and others, then in that case, this working group would gather comments from you, from the community, and would relay that to, well, probably the envisioned working group Chris has been talking about this morning that is on its way as a joint action from the NSOs, and probably another way of conduct would be that we might even participate in a joint approach how to move on with the DNS cert initiative. So that's basically what's planned for the upcoming days of the working group.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Great piece of work. Any comments or questions for Jörg? Okay. Thank you very much, Jörg. That's brilliant. Thank you. Marvellous. Okay, so we're going to move on now to the last session for the day, which is Delegation, Redelegation, Retirement Working Group. Bernie, Keith, if you will please join me. And Bart. And Bart, just in case, Bart's leg's stuck under the chair or something, it's clearly... Judging by the noises he's making, anyway.
And Gabby, is it all?
So, the idea of this session is that can I just get an idea how many of you were in the GAC room with us just a while ago? Pretty much a lot. Okay. So, thank you. So, for those that weren't, we went through a slideshow for the GAC that talks about this working group's progress report and the big report that we've published, and we're going to do that, do some more of that now, and hopefully have a discussion on in a bit more, perhaps in a bit more depth than we did with the GAC. And Keith, over to you.
Thank you, Chris. I'll spend a bit of time in a bit more detail of some of the aspects of the progress of the working group here, but I really don't want to be too repetitive in terms of covering the same ground twice. So I hope everyone was in the GAC session and that we might be able to get through some aspects of this a little bit more rapidly. And just in general terms, again, I'll walk through the progress of the working group and then hand over to Bernie to walk us through some considerably more examples of some of the findings of the working group and their analysis and so on. Now, all I need is a page down. I want to see it too. What's page down? No. Oh, I'll do it here. I'll do it here.
There.
Oh, that's pretentious.
No.
No.
This is not from there.
Oh, okay. Okay. No. Okay. Okay, in terms of members of the working group, it is a very large working group. I don't intend to go through the entire list of names, but there are representatives from throughout the CCNSO community. There are some members of the Government Advisory Committee, and there are some expert advisors from ICANN and elsewhere. And quite a substantial number of ICANN staff supporters. And this presentation will be online if it isn't already. So if you have some questions, feel free to tackle your local or close by member of this working group to raise any questions or issues with them or with me or Bernie or Bart or Chris. Okay, the document that we've released is the draft issues document, and it's made up of three main parts. There's public consultation questions, a methodology to evaluate what we see as potentially interesting cases, and the analysis of 16 interesting cases. The methodology was... or the questions that we would like answers on and submissions from you on between now and the 15th of September are the following. The first is the reality check. Is the methodology developed and employed adequate for the purposes of the working group? Do the policy statements identified provide adequate baseline to evaluate the actual practices of IANA and the ICANN board relative to delegation and redelegation and retirement of CCTLDs? And are there other policy statements which are applicable for the work of the delegation and redelegation working group? Should they be included in the baseline? Now, the sorts of things that could come up there, there are some earlier RFCs like RFC 920 and 980 and 1020 that refer to registrations of top-level domains and so on. We've put out a call in the past and we'll continue to call for any documentation on any delegation or redelegation of a country code that occurred prior to the formation of ICANN in 1998. We haven't been able to uncover any of that documentation. So if you know of somebody who may have an early delegation email from John Postel or something like that, we would really appreciate receiving a copy. And if you have any other indications of policies that you think this working group should take into account, please let us know. Does the documentation identified provide an adequate representation of actual practices by IANA and the ICANN board and, relative to the delegation, redelegation and retirement of CCTLDs? Should other cases be included for analysis? Is there other documentation which is applicable to the work of the working group which should be analysed? And so we have this open period. The documentation's all online and the consultation is scheduled to close on 15 September to allow us time to consider the submissions and incorporate them into a report going forward to the ICANN meeting in December. And on to the methodology, and I'll hand over to Bernie. Thanks.
I think I'll move over here because I can't see that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi, folks. Yes, it's me. All right, methodology. Just to recap on the history, if you missed it, we did go through every single IANA report in detail, every single sponsorship agreement, MOU, and all the annexes and all the board decisions that referred to CCTLDs. We sort of did an initial sort into, pretty straightforward, nothing to go with it. And here there are a couple of issues. We took those and we started looking at them and then developed a methodology for analyzing certain aspects relative to existing policy frameworks to see if they matched up, because that's an easy call. I mean, if you define the framework properly, you have a look at it, either they met the requirements or they didn't. It doesn't mean it's the only thing that we're looking at in the scope of the working group, but this one is, I guess, what we could call low-lying fruit. It's fairly easy to come up with an empirical revision of what's happening. Once we finished developing the methodology against a certain number of cases, we then went through that second set of cases and sort of re-looked at them and looked at the interesting ones and came up with the 16. So what I'm going to do now is just walk you through quickly a more detailed version of the analysis process. As we said in the GAC, we really tried to keep it simple. Three classes, significantly interesting, meaning it would strongly support the recommendation of a PDP. Interesting, may support or could support the recommendation of a PDP. And possibly interesting, would probably not support the recommendation of a PDP. Of the 16 cases that we had selected after that, they essentially fell into two classes. The cases that were related to policy-type development, implicit or explicit, and we'll get into that in a few minutes, and cases which were strictly related to the application of existing policies. And when you put them together, you get a matrix of six elements. Are we good to hear? Okay, moving right along. There will be a test before you're allowed to leave, so you should pay attention.
And I'm making notes of people with their eyes closed.
You don't want that. In examining the cases, the working group considered a simple way to sort of help categorize these things. We made a decision tree. Firstly, does the difference between the policy statements and the documentation or the issues that we're looking at, i.e. the board decisions, suggest a change in policy applicable to the delegation, redelegation, or retirement of ISO 3166-1 CCTLD? So we're trying to keep it framed in the mandate of the working group. The board did take other decisions. We're not into that. We're into these things. And to help answer that question, we came up with four criteria. These differences identified involved an explicit or implicit board decision that concerns the delegation, redelegation, or retirement of CCTLDs. The core elements of the approach reflected in the documentation appear to be inconsistent with or not addressed by an existing policy statement. If policy says you can do A, and you've gone and done A and B, well, you know, you've got to see how that goes. The changes will bring noticeable changes. It's not a question, it's a question of size of impact, too. I mean, if you don't follow the rules perfectly, but it has no significant impact, it's probably not worth wasting all our time looking at that. Sorry. So really, there has to be a question of significant impact. The differences identified in the fourth term relate to something that could be applied broadly, i.e. involve an approach that is likely to have lasting value or applicability albeit with the need for occasional updates. What we're saying here is that it's fairly obvious that the rule that's been passed can be applied to others, even if it requires some minor changes or adaptations. So those are the four elements of the decision tree that is our first test, if you will, to decide if the element, the decision element we're considering, is a change in policy or not, regardless whether it's called that. We help classify that, which is why we say implicit or not. If the answer to all four questions is yes, the working group considered the differences to be a change in policy. If the answer is yes to the first three questions, then the working group determined that the differences probably reflected a change in policy. Other combinations are probably not a change in policy. Now, if the working group determined that the gap between the policy statements and the documentation in any particular case did reflect or probably reflected a change in policy, the working group considered whether or not the change was undertaken in accordance with applicable procedural requirements or policy changes. All right, I've read it. What does it mean? What it means, and it's described in detail in the longer version of the report, is that ICANN has published rules for developing policy. I mean, if you classify it as a policy, if it looks like a policy, it smells like a policy, it walks like a policy, it's probably a policy, right? And if it's a policy, there are rules that are applicable to how you define policies and make them for the ICANN board. Now, before the CCNSO, the scope, the requirements for creating policies was a lot lighter. And we described that in detail, and I'm not going to go through that here. After the CCNSO, life changed. Life changed because there was the CCNSO, and life changed because, in general, the procedures for developing policies within ICANN evolved significantly. There were very clear lines marked in the sand and put into the bylaws about what it means for the ICANN board to be able to develop a policy. Where the working group identified no change of policy, considered whether or not the documentation reflected an implementation of policy, i.e., the decisions we looked at, if they're clearly covered by a policy, then we have to look at, okay, fine, but did they follow the policy that's there that covers this case? The absence of policy. In an organization such as ICANN, where the board of directors makes a decision that can be cited in the future, such decisions should be viewed as affecting policy, even if under the circumstances the decision only applies to a single CCTLD because it sets a precedent. This is fairly standard procedure. I mean, the reality is if the board makes a decision in the context where there is no policy, it is setting policy whether it likes it or not. Okay. So, are we good up until this point? So, we've got basically two major blocks we're looking at. Okay? We looked at those 16 cases and said, is it a change in policy or is it an application of policy? And we've got those four questions that help us answer that. The second thing, once we've answered that, whether it's an application of policy or a development of policy, we look at, did they follow the rules? If it's an application of policy, well, the thing we're looking at for following the rules is, did it follow the policy? If we're looking at a development of policy, we list the various terms that are required at the time the decision was taken, because you have to remember that the rules change as time goes along. So at the time the decision was taken, we have a look at what the conditions are and if those conditions were met for that kind of work and decision. So what we're going to do next is we will go through in not excruciatingly painful details, but we will go through in details the analysis of one case, okay, what it ends up reading in the long document to give you an idea of the work that was actually done. And then after that, we'll skim through the remaining 15 cases. There's actually 14, but that's a long story. So our first one is the same one we used with the GAC, but now you're going to see we've got the next level of detail in going through it. And it's the September 25th, 2000 ISO 3166 reserve list decision. I'm not going to go through the motion. It's up there. And basically, the board came up and said, okay, under specific circumstances, we can create CCTLDs from the ISO 3166 reserve list. Boom. All right. So let's take a look at that under the framework of analysis we've defined. Under the first part, this is an explicit... This is an explicit decision by the board that concerns the delegation of CCTLDs. I mean, you will be creating a new class of CCTLDs. Allowing for a new class of CCTLDs is a significant change for CCTLDs. The decision generates noticeable change. I mean, there's a whole new class of players that can become CCTLDs. So our evaluation is that it's noticeable. The board decision is not specific to a given CCTLD. It says we can, under a set of circumstances, allow new CCTLDs from the reserve list. It's not about a specific entity. It seems to meet that test. Thank you. I'm getting too excited here.
It's hard not to be excited about this.
I know. Look, they're captivated. Don't go into a trance yet. Come on. The last of the four questions, the core elements of this decision were not covered by existing policies at the time of the decision. No CCTLDs from the ISO 3166-1 exceptionally reserved list had been allocated since the inception of ICP-1. And remember, we're covering the period of stuff during ICANN's reign. We're not looking at the other stuff in the context of the applicability of policies. So we have to limit ourselves to that framework. IANA has approved CCTLDs from this list in the past. However, this was prior to RFC 1591 even being in existence, and ICANN. And there's some other stuff there. So basically, the conclusion as to whether this is a change of policy or not, if you look at those four things, is that this is an explicit decision by the board that meets the four criteria from the decision tree and supports the working group classifying this decision as a change in policy. All right, so that's how we work through all these cases, exactly the same way. You look at them, you will find the same logic in every case. All right, so now we've picked off that this one is a change in policy according to our set of criteria. All right, what are the set of rules that were in effect at the time? And they were light, because this was 2000. This was before the new and more accountable ICANN and the reform came in. I mean, basically, you had to tell people you were developing a policy. You had to hold a meeting and have input, and that was about all the requirements you had to have to develop a policy. So I always cite the date because the set of criteria changes in time. So the policy development requirements, according to Section 3 notice and comment provisions of the bylaws in effect at the time, which basically were the same since the inception of ICANN, was, as I said, to provide public notice on the website, provide reasonable opportunity for parties to comment, and to hold public forum at which the proposed policy would be discussed. But we're not talking serious requirements here. And the evaluation is, there is no record of a public consultation on the topic, there is no record of a public forum discussion on the topic, and there is no record of any communications between the board and the DNSO at the time, before the CCNSO, on this matter that could be considered advice. So, basically, this one is fairly easy, if you're using this scheme, to conclude that this policy decision failed to meet all of the requirements for policy development in effect at the time and supports the working group classifying this as significantly interesting. As I say, again, the approach, you will find this in every single case. Sometimes it's longer. In some cases, we've actually pulled out all the elements from RFC 1591, all the elements from ICP-1, all the elements from the GAC principles, and looked at each one and how they apply and what they mean. And so sometimes just that evaluation part can run to two or three pages of quotes and pieces that we picked up from there. But we always try to go back to the documentation that is available publicly. So that's the detailed analysis of the first case. I don't know if we've got questions on this specific one and how we use the process. I'll take that as a stunning endorsement of my skills as a presenter. Thank you. As I said, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, where we thought it was useful, we added in some comments after we completed the analysis. Now, obviously, the change of allowing elements from the ISO reserve list is fairly clearly a change of policy. Yet, if you go through the document, you'll notice there's never any mention that there's been a change in policy, which is sort of interesting. Even 5 years later, we're getting documents that are being published that say, no, no, the only policy applicable to CCTLDs is ICP1. Anyways, it's an interesting sideline. So what I've done next is I've taken them by the three classes, possibly interesting, interesting, and significantly interesting, and I'm just listing off the cases for you. So under possibly interesting, we've got the September 10th, 2001 AU redelegation relative to sponsorship agreements. Okay, because it came as a bit of a shock for those that were around at that time that all of a sudden you couldn't be redelegated unless you signed a sponsorship agreement. And basically, if you run through the mechanics, given that the sponsorship agreement rule was passed, they basically followed the rules. So from a sponsorship agreement point of view, it's only possibly interesting. Similarly, with the EU decision in March 2005, basically, once you accept the ISO 3166-1 reserved list decision, when they did delegate .eu, it basically followed the rules if you basically accept the fact that the reserved list decision was a policy decision. We next go into the interesting cases, the September 25th, 2000, which is, yes, the same date, the same ICANN board meeting where they decided on the 3166 reserve list decision, they also decided on sponsorship agreements were required for anything going forward. And this ends up being classified as interesting because they followed some of the rules, okay? The sponsorship agreements were basically three versions were posted on the website that were discussed at several ICANN meetings. Now, through all that traffic, if you read all the sources of public information, no one ever mentioned that sponsorship agreements would be absolutely, totally, and unquestionably required for redelegation. We were just looking at potential models for an agreement. And when it came to September 25th, they said, we have this great agreement. Now you can't get a delegation or a redelegation without a sponsorship agreement. So that one ends up being interesting. September 10th, 2001, not allowing individual delegees for CCTLDs. Again, for about the same reasons, because it got covered in the same backhanded way. If you read through all the versions of the draft sponsorship agreements, it's there. It's actually there. It's not really clear what it means, but once you put all the dots together, it becomes fairly clear that's what they were meaning. However, it was there. People failed to comment on it. We'll skip over the fact that public comment periods at that time, if you have negative comments, and I know because I was at some of those meetings, never got recorded for some reason. But we're forgetting that, okay? There's a whole period of about 4 years where ICANN must have been doing a great job because there was never a negative comment recorded in any public consultation. We move on to the next interesting case, which is July 18, 2006, the .gd redelegation. there starts to be some questions about internet community support. I mean, in all the IANA documentation and everything else, it has always been a gold standard that there was an evaluation of local internet community support when you're talking about a redelegation. And this one's got some issues, which is why it got flagged as interesting. In November 2007, we have the .bb redelegation, where it's sort of weird, but it's clearly stated in one of the official statements that the applicant did not meet the technical requirements. But the board chose to redelegate anyways, and that was a first. So, again, the other criteria were met, so it got put in the middle pile, which sort of says, interesting. Before we go into the significantly interesting, are we doing okay? Not too many people are walking out. All right.
Two of them nodding there. Right?
Yeah, two of them nodding over there. Well, well, they're Kiwis. All right, not that long. We're into the home stretch now. We're heading into significantly interesting. And hopefully it'll be significantly interesting. All right, let's go. May 1999, ICP-1. Yes, we dared take on ICP-1. Basically, there is one part in ICP-1. If you take the first statement in ICP-1 that says there is no change in policy, all right, which was always the reason ICANN said it didn't need the board to approve it, because it wasn't a change in policy. If you go through it and you actually do the homework, we're saying that's not true. There is a change of policies when it comes to the ability to redelegate. And it's fairly clear, and if you go through the analysis, I think it sort of falls out rather clearly. And it did not meet any of the requirements for policy decision. As we all know, ICP-1 was simply published. And that just happened. So that gets a rating of significantly interesting. How did that end up there? Oh, the reserve. No. Sorry. That's a miscopy on the 3166 reserve list decision. Oh, no. What am I talking about? On ISO 3166 reserve list, we've gone through the case, and we've explained to you why it ended up being significantly interesting. November 19, 2001, the .us redelegation ended up getting a quote of significantly interesting for a lot of reasons. This one's a little special. There are no board decisions, there are no board minutes, and there is no IANA report, and there is no sponsorship agreement. However, we have dug up a significant amount of information on this one, and if you are interested in CC matters and wish to read a very interesting story, if you have not followed it, I would highly recommend that if you not pick anything else, you read that one. June 9, 2004, the .ly redelegation for Libya. All of a sudden we get a new term. We have a provisional redelegation where it's not clear where that comes from, but all of a sudden we have provisional redelegations. You run it through the mechanics and it ends up being significantly interesting. July 28, 2005, the .kz redelegation. What's interesting about this one is that the September 2000 decision, which was a policy that passed by the board that says going forward, all redelegations will require the delegee to have a sponsorship agreement. So that's in effect. And this is the first decision 5 years later where a CCTLD is redelegated without a sponsorship agreement. And there is no mention of why. Okay, is just redelegated. What's even more interesting is in the board minutes, this entire discussion, although there is no mention as to why there is no sponsorship agreement, where IANA gets beaten up for still having that requirement on its web page. And if you go through the Wayback Machine, it actually gets removed the week after without any notice also. So anyways, you finish going through the analysis, and it's significantly interesting. January 16, 2007, the .um undelegation, which is the first removal from the root of an active ISO 3166-1 code. Now, some people say, well, you know, no one wanted to operate it anymore. And if you're not familiar with the .um code, it's the Outlying Minor Islands, which is a chattel of the U.S. government and has penguins on it, I think. So anyways, the penguins were not using the domain too much. No one wanted to run it. However, the reality in a policy analysis framework is that there's nothing on the books, ICP-1, RFC 1591, et cetera, there's nothing on the book that says we're allowed to remove a valid ISO 3166 that's been delegated from production. So it ends up being quoted like this. September 11, 2007, the .yu redelegation. We actually get two of those because two different cases. There's the redelegation part where all of a sudden we get new terminology again that means something completely different again. We get a temporary caretaker redelegation. Nothing else to back this up anywhere else. It just sort of mentions that, you know, we're redelegating to a new manager, but you can't register new names. So it's a special redelegation. So anyways, that got classified as significantly interesting. And then there are the elements of the .yu retirement, where also, if you go through the documentation, there's nothing that talks about how you retire a CCTLD that's no longer going to be on the list. And then all of a sudden, not only are we talking about retiring it, but a bunch of very specific conditions about when and how it's going to be retired. So if you run it through the mill, basically, it just ends up being significantly interesting. The final one, 2008, is the .AE redelegation. And this one is really a confirmation, if you will, that, you know, there can be redelegations without any serious local internet community support, to the point where one of the directors actually, couldn't support the motion, made the point in the minutes, and filed a document after the meeting stating his requirements. All the annexes, all the elements, we're not asking you to dig up URLs. We've cut and pasted them into the document, which is why it's 110 pages. Well worth the read, I assure you. So that's what we ended up with. Were there other cases which, on the face of it, we were interested at? Yes, and we had to make a decision at some point which ones to keep, but maybe we got it wrong, which is why we're running a consultation. We're not just running a consultation for the other SOs or things. We're asking everyone to have a look at it. If we've gotten something wrong, please tell us. We'll be glad to relook at all the cases. I don't think we've forgotten any cases. I have been, I think, fairly detail-oriented at going through every single one of them. And some of them, it was borderline if we were going to include them or not. But we tried to generate a good set of examples that were clear. And there are the references, and I'll be glad to take questions. Or the other gentleman to my right.
And Chris, you wanted to make an observation.
I just wanted to make an observation. Just in case it's not blindingly obvious, we're not judging whether these decisions were good or bad. Okay, I mean, it may be that the right thing to do was this, but that's not the criteria. The criteria is, was it within policy? Some of these decisions you might think are great decisions, some of these decisions you might think are appalling decisions. But that's not relevant to this analysis. I just want to make sure that, because I'm conscious, and we, in fact, we're all conscious, because we've all been around a very long time, conscious that, you know, this could, we don't want this to be perceived as trying to bash people up or, you know, attack people's integrity or anything like that. This is purely looking at it from a policy mechanics. So some of those decisions I think we would think are good or bad, but I just wanted to make sure that was absolutely clear. Thanks.
Yeah, I was trying to make that point. The one that's the most clear is the .um revocation. I mean, it's clearly way out of line from a policy point of view, but what are you going to do if you've got a CCTLD that no one wants to run? I mean, so we're not trying to rehash history. We're not commenting on the end results. We're looking at the mechanics, because what's important in the context of a group like us, you've got to be able to trust the mechanics, and that's all we're looking at. Right. Did I make that clear enough?
I think so, but just to absolutely re-emphasize it, this draft report is not seeking to invite relitigation of any individual delegation or redelegation. It's nor is it an opportunity to castigate the ICANN board for having stepped outside of policy or having had a too broader interpretation of policy. It is merely to document where there have been gaps and how they might be remedied, whether they can be remedied outside of a PDP or not. And remember that this working group is not particularly interested in the individual instances of a delegation or redelegation, but more the overarching aspects of how IANA and the board have acted within their guidelines and policies. Just one more point before I totally open that up for questions. That is that we had a shorter presentation set of slides for the GAC today. There's this presentation, and there's also a slightly more substantial 60 PowerPoint or 60 slide presentation, which are all going up on the website. I think they were pushed last night, but I can't find them yet. But if at the very least, the least interest you want to show in the subject is, I think, to go and have a look at the 60-slide PowerPoint presentation, which is a bullet point summary of the progress report and the issues uncovered. And I hope that that would then tempt you to read the 110-page document make some submissions. Anyway, I think we've been talking from here enough.
We can have a midnight showing of the 60 slides if people are really interested.
So, and the main point of today is to actually encourage some feedback and further discussion. So, Hilda.
Thank you. Hilda Tunen from the Norwegian Registry. I would first like to say thank you to the working group, because this is a substantial amount of work in actually going through a lot of very complicated cases and looking for a pattern. And I would like to echo your comment that what we're actually seeing here is a pattern. Some of the times, the decisions made would have been perfectly common sense decisions. I can think of decisions I would wholeheartedly support, like dropping the sponsorship agreement requirement. But it would, of course, have been nice if procedure for making the decisions were followed. And I think what I get out of your presentation, and might get out of reading the report, if I ever get that far, is the feeling that at this point in time it would be useful to look more into how a delegation and redelegation happens and what kind of policy actually applies to it and how that policy is implemented. But I would like to ask you a question. You were looking at delegations and redelegation. What kind of definition did you use to find out when a redelegation had happened? Did you look for IANA reports? For changes in the IANA database, what did you do to
Purely at the ICANN board decisions and the IANA reports, remembering that IANA and ICANN only publish reports and resolutions where there is a successful redelegation. So we've not looked at, and nor should we be able to look at, any application for a redelegation that failed.
No, that's okay, but if there was a case where the organisation, the registry changed without an IANA report or a board decision, you would not have flagged it?
If there was no public documentation relative to a change, did not enter here. Public documentation in some way related to the ICANN site.
So merely the change in the IANA database would not be something you would actually discover? Okay. I might have a case for you later.
Brilliant. Absolutely marvellous. If there's something that's been missed, then that's really fantastic. That, not that it's been missed, but that you can tell us about it.
And, there is no documentation that we have looked at that isn't publicly available. So we have gathered together a resource of that information, which if this working group does recommend a PDP, the resource of documentation that we've amassed in one point should be a valuable resource to a PDP working group.
Just to confirm that, I mean, it's not included in the full report, but there's probably about, I would guess, 700 pages of annexes to support the 110-page report. So we didn't want to do that to anyone, but Keith is quite right. We didn't simply cut and paste from the website and say, that's it. Everything is structured, documented. Each case was analyzed separately with all public documentation that is available, even though it may not all be included in the report. In the report, we tried to keep it to the things that were extremely salient to the points we were trying to make or the notes that we made after the decision. But in each case, if we decide, as Keith says, if we decide to go forward, we're not starting up again trying to get the documentation. It's all there.
The reason why I ask the question is that the ENO registry was reorganized during this period, where the registry was split out from the company it was originally part of and became a separate company. The delegation was moved from one company to another. We argued to IANA, being conscious of the requirement to sign a sponsorship agreement, that this was not a redelegation, and they accepted it. And I was uncertain whether you would have viewed it as a redelegation or not. The name of the company did change in the IANA database, but there was, of course, no board decision or other things because it was a case of the personnel and machinery moving from one company to a daughter company of the original one.
If you send me the information, I'll be glad to put it through the sausage mill and see what pops out the other end.
Patricia.
Thank you. Patricia Poblete from NIC Chile. I believe this is an extremely important matter, important enough for me to stay here and not go to watch the Mexico-Uruguay match. Having said that, I must confess that I signed up as an observer in this working group and was not very active at the beginning to the extent of not being included in the mailing list and not noticing for the fact for a few months. But once I got in, I couldn't help but being drawn into this, and I think I have to congratulate my colleagues who have done all this huge amount of work, because the sheer volume is in itself very valuable information. Personally, I was not aware that so many redelegations have happened. A large portion of the CCTLDs have been redelegated. Many of the people here have been the recipients of a CCTLD after a redelegation. That was new to me, that it was such a large number. And I think that this case-by-case study is very interesting. It allows us to examine in detail how things have evolved. But It is only a part of what's needed for us as a working group to answer the question that was posed by the Council. The real question had to do with us analyzing the current policies and guidelines, and to report on any issues or matters of concern that exist with those current policies. So it is the current policies that are most important to consider, and the analysis that's expected is not just a formal one, but I think it's more substantial in the sense of trying to determine if some of those current policies are somehow inadequate. Certainly, if we determine that through history the ICANN board hasn't always done things properly, that's one reason for considering that perhaps this needs to be looked into through a PDP. But if that analysis had led us to the conclusion that the ICANN board had always consistently followed the policies in effect at the time, so there was absolutely no deviation, that still wouldn't mean that there is no need for a PDP. Okay? And if the analysis of this impressive work leads us to the conclusion that there is a need for a PDP, or maybe if it leads us to the opposite conclusion, I would think that we as a working group still need to do go into the substance of the current policies and try to say something about them, be it that we consider that they are adequate or that we consider that they are not, and present some evidence to support that. Because otherwise, I fear that suppose we go into a PDP, that we could think that the PDP only has to do with those violations that have happened through history, while I think that the more pressing matters are those of now, not of the past.
Thank you, Patricia. Chris.
Yeah. Patricia, I agree with what you said, and there's more work to do, obviously. But actually, I think that this analysis informs that assessment, because if you look at what's actually happening, that helps you to consider whether what you've got that is supposed to govern what is happening is actually adequate. So to take a simple example, it would be fairly easy, I would suggest, to draw this conclusion, to draw the conclusion that the analysis document indicates that the current policy principles, whatever you want to call them, are lacking in detail and thus allowing the board to colour in the detail themselves. And so it might be possible to draw the conclusion based on this that clearly, therefore, there is a need for the detail, for the colour. Now, whether that means you need a PDP or not is a different issue. I'm not saying that the stuff you've talked about doesn't need to be done. I'm saying that this informs that discussion, I think.
Yes, but if I may comment on that... the fact that this analysis concentrates so much on whether the ICANN board has always followed the policies in effect at the time has the risk of distracting us from the analysis of the substance of the current policies to consider whether they are adequate or not.
And Benny, you wanted to...
Patricio, we were exactly... I was exactly where you are. And what you're saying is we have to analyze the policies that apply today. Well, the reality is we had to do this exercise to understand what were the policies that apply today. So I'm not arguing with you at all, but given the state of what is available, unfortunately, which is completely weird in an organization like this, by the way, we had... to create the mechanics to find out what the policies are.
Just one quick thing. As we say in academia, what I'm trying to say is that more work needs to be done.
Oh, absolutely. And I think this is a work in progress, but this is a
point in time where the working group needs to receive validation from the community that we're on the right track, or be told that we're completely wrong, start again. So, we have to move down the path step at a time. Chris,
Can I? It's Yuri Demchenko. Question. I looked through document. I see that you really refer to both, for all three documents, where it's policy related. But my question is, what's your observation? How strict or how clearly I can use GAG documents in their decision? Because sometimes it's not clear.
Let me make sure I've understood your question. Yeah. You're asking, I think, have I can always use the documents, the three documents, in the decision-making process?
In particular, GAG documents, because they are the most restricted for example, redelegation and for government approval.
I think you're right. I think it's unclear whether they have actually used the documents or not. It's unclear. We don't know.
Yeah. And another question is... what's your observation? How strict I can use GAG principles? Because they are sometimes more restricted than ICP.
I think there are variations along the path as to what policies the board have felt more strongly about for individual decisions. But the issue is more the issue around the interpretation of the policy. For example, taking the ISO 3166-1 list and saying is able to delegate reserved name or names from the reserved list as CCTLDs, the only reference to the ISO list is in RFC 1591, which states that the ISO 3166 list will be used. Now, there is no such thing as an ISO 3166 list. It's an ISO 3166-something list, of which one is the reserved list. So ICANN board have applied an interpretation of the policy, and it's whether that's within scope or not. Stephen.
I'd like to thank Bernie and the other members of the working group for producing what I think is a pretty brilliant document. This morning we were told by a board member, no less, that it is not the role of the ICANN board to make policy. What I'm seeing here makes it really hard for me to reconcile that statement with reality. I have a question for Bernie and other working group members, and I don't mean it to be a facetious question, but given all that you've uncovered with respect to policy making by the board with respect to redelegations, at any point during this process, did you detect a sense of embarrassment on the part of ICANN with respect to this?
Let me say something, then Bernie can say what he wants. I go back to what I said before. But the purpose of this is not to put people on the spot. I personally don't believe there has been a concerted, conscious effort on the part of the ICANN board in its various guises over the last 10 years to deliberately ignore, change, move, etc., 1591, GAC, whatever.
I don't either, but I'm just impressed at the extent of essentially a random walk through the last decade of ad hoc policymaking.
I think there was a period where ICANN believed itself to be open and transparent and bottom-up consensus decision-making body, providing it used those words, but it could do anything as long as it could use those words once a day. For those of us that remember those years, they weren't happy years in ICANN, and they subsequently moved on under the Stuart Lynn ICANN 2 model to actually becoming more committed to a process of open policy development. And I think what we're seeing today is a very different environment again. But remember that this is a policy that is almost an exclusive right of the CCNSO to create. And you know, the actual issue of delegations and redelegations and its policies is an issue that is entirely within the scope of the CCNSO to create and go forward. So it is a bottom-up process rather than top-down.
Before he goes away, what I will say, I agree with what both my esteemed colleagues have said here, but I would invite you to read the full report.
Okay, and...
Yes, this is Jaap Akkerhuis, and I want to make a clarification about the status of the reserved list, because this is before... Because the reserved list is not an ISO list. ISO had been stamped as three lists, 3166. There's one with its countries. There's two, which is actually parts inside countries, and three, which is historic. The reserved list is a list for the maintenance agent only, officially. So it's not part of really of ISO, but it contains codes which are, you know, scheduled to become on the list or not, and that also has codes for various other reasons. But I just want to make sure that it's not understood this is an ISO standard. It's just a list of a working list.
Thank you. I hadn't seen you in the room, so I thought I'd get away with that as an example, and there's no better person to talk to us about the ISO 3166 list, but thank you for the clarification. Over here.
Alberto Pérez from Spain, .es. My comment was quite in line with that of Hilde, our Norwegian colleague, because in the case of Spain, redelegation took place during 2004, and there was no sponsorship agreement signed. So I've read in the screen that Kazakhstan was considered a change of policy. So I'm not very sure about how dates are taken into account, because the IANA report is published with date of 2005, but is referring to events that took place during 2004. I have to say it's a very unfortunate process, because it took 9 months when it was clear-cut. It was one branch of the government giving it in the best terms of cooperation to another with everyone in perfect agreement, but took 9 months because we were trying to be forced to sign agreements. We would not agree, but we sent a letter saying that we might study how to sign in the future an accountability framework or something similar. This is even listed in the IANA report, and that was considered as enough. So it has struck me to see the Kazakhstan case as changing policy, but maybe the dates can get wrong, because the IANA report is published with a much later date than than when the events took place.
I'll review my dates again, but if I remember correctly, and there's a lot of documentation, so as we said, this is out there for comments like that, so we can get all our stuff right. I believe the decision was made to take the Kazakhstan example as the one, because in the case of the Kazakhstan example, there was nothing. There was no letter. While in the Spanish one, there was that letter saying, oh, we might sign one later on. So I wanted to take a case that was absolutely clear where there was no reference.
No, but I was making the point, like Hilde, that the dates can be a bit confusing.
Yes.
Because, thank you.
Oh, please. Yes, please give us your submission and any clarifying documentation you have. Siavash.
Hi, I'm Siavash from Iran. I'd like to ask you about the nature of evidence you observed in for community support in the redelegations you studied. I could also ask the same question about the nature of the local support you get for fast track, although I know it's being covered by a different thing.
IANA, in most cases, does not make any formal documentation, which is a show of support of local community, internet community support, available, okay, in the documentation. So the standard that we use in analyzing the documents was trying to gather clear statements in both the IANA report and the board minutes that there was support. If we had both of those, then it was we would accept clearly, without any other document that is available publicly on the IANA site, that there was support. If there was only one of those two, it was a bit of a judgment call. And if neither were there, that's why you ended up with those two cases, which are documented. So, as we said when we started out, we worked with information that is available to everyone, that is on the website. It's not because we've got full documents, copies of the full documents in the analysis that you have to believe us. You can go and do the research yourself, get the URLs, and get those documents. But we limited ourselves to documents that were available to avoid any type of questions, well, we can show this, we can't show that. So we based ourselves purely on stuff that is publicly available on the ICANN site for supporting the given questions that we were looking at.
Would you consider desirable to have something more formal in the future, PDP, about this community support?
Could you repeat your question just to make sure I understood it properly?
Would you consider desirable to have a more formal evidence for community support in the future PDP or whatever?
I don't think we really know. It's, you know, one of those questions that, you know, could be answered by a PDP. But the point is we're trying to bring together points. And, you know, the question you're asking is a meta point, as far as I'm concerned, because throughout all the documentation, I think without it being a stated policy, they just don't give evidence of support. So is that desirable or not? I think it's for the group and the community to comment on.
Patricia.
Yeah, I don't know if Kim is in the room. I wanted to know if there is an audit trail for the IANA database so one can search and find out what was in the IANA database at any given point in the past.
I think the working group did ask the question, and somebody generated a quite useful report of the dates of changes. Eberhardt did. But we didn't find it necessarily useful in terms of the examination and analysis of these decisions. I mean, we haven't tried to capture every single instance of every single thing that's happened. We're more testing where the bus has been going and when it's been going off the road and how far off the road it's been going on its journey. And so I think now is a period for discussion about whether the breaches of policy, if you like, are sufficient to warrant a PDP, or that we're happy enough as a community to just carry on in the future without a PDP. So those are the sorts of questions we'd like to see answered in the submissions. Okay, are there any... over here, Stephen.
Elizabeth Portney used to keep meticulous track of changes to the IANA database, and if you were looking for a definitive record up until I don't know how recently, that would probably be your go-to source to answer Patricio's question.
Thank you. I think we're done. If there's nothing else, no further questions, I'd like to record my thanks to Bernie for his excellent research and analysis skills and keeping our working group fully participative in terms of working on that analysis and so on, and to Bart for his great work in terms of reminding us of our limitations and our working group charter and so on, and to Gabby and Christina for their support of the working group, and I think Kim Davies and Jaap Akkerhuis as ICANN's expert advisors to this group and the willingness that they've shared information with us. And I'd also like to thank you all in advance for your submissions that will be forthcoming between now and the 15th of September. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Keith. Thank you, Bernie. Thank you, Bart. It's time for us to close for the day, except, of course, we're all going out. Well, it's not all, but some of us are going out for dinner. Gabby has sent an email around to all of the lists with the survey for the day. Please fill in the survey on the web so that we can work out whether we're still doing this okay or not. So that everyone should have all three of the lists should have a link to do that. Please try and do it soon rather than in a week and a half's time when you don't remember whether it was today or tomorrow that we did stuff and you've got no clue whether it was any fun or not. So if you wouldn't mind doing it soon, that would be great. We start again in a different room tomorrow at 9 o'clock. We're in the ARC, so come in twos, tomorrow at 9 o'clock. And thank you all very much indeed for your participation today, and we'll see you all in the morning. Thank you.